KC2RW, KC2YDT.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. So, I think we're slowly concluding that a jammer for cell phones is a severe attempt at a solution, and it looks like it's got a lot more disadvantages than advantages. It's attacking the symptoms of the problem, not the real problem, and because nowadays a cell phone is strongly a safety device. I mean, when you get a town like Hempstead that declares a moratorium and won't allow new cell sites to be installed for the next 6 months or a year, and then the new ones being installed must be 500 feet from any residence, place of worship, or school. Where in the world did that number 500 feet come from? It's a rabbit hat trick number written by a consultant from Florida that was hired by Hempstead, he also recommended that they force a new cell site application to prove that it's required. In other words, the cell company applying for the new cell site has to prove that it's really required. That's a crazy requirement, because no matter what metric is used, the people in town hall will not understand it. Therefore, they've got to go back to that same consultant who interprets it for them. They haven't been smart enough to realize he is generating business for himself by doing this. There's no justification for the 500 number. There's no justification for proving it's required, because the company putting up a cell site is investing $750,000 of their hard-earned money. The fact that they're willing to put up $750,000 is proof positive that they think they're going to make a profit margin on it and that there's a need. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. That's the proof positive. You don't need any other requirement. And the 500-foot rule outlaws everything in the town other than the middle of the park, if you know what I mean. Even that, you might not make it. So therefore, there are no cell sites that can be put in.
Repeater. My mouth. Repeater.
When you don't allow new cell sites to put in, and the reason why the cell company wanted to do it is because they thought they had improper coverage. And if you do have improper coverage, it's just a matter of time before an accident occurs and a person doesn't get emergency services soon enough and therefore perishes, and the survivors of that person sues the town for criminal negligent homicide because there wasn't allowed a cell site to do it. It's just a matter of time before a smart attorney comes up with that kind of a lawsuit. So to restrict cell site installations on what you believe is biohazard is wrong. It's against federal law, by the way. Communication Act of 1996 says you cannot deny the siting of a cell site based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. The government has been down that road so many times, and time after time, all of your individual zoning boards start applying those rules, which have no basis in fact. It's just pleasing the requirements of what the community thinks they want. If you're the mayor of a town and you're controlling the situation, you're in a very delicate situation. You have to supply to that town what they need, not what they want. And you have to educate them as to what they need. To restrict cell sites and to put up moratoriums for it, in almost all cases, is a lethal decision that is dead wrong. I emphasize the word dead. That's a strongly felt opinion. Anyone got any opinions on all of this? Let me see if Chris is still within driving range. Let's see if he's got an opinion on this. KB2IQN, K2RIW in the tech net.
KB2IQN, yes, I have an opinion on this. I actually made you happen to know, I did a presentation in my wireless communications class on RF biohazard, specifically because a lot of electrical engineers in my school didn't know anything about the RF biohazard, the information that the FCC has, for instance, like about how safe it is, or about the IEEE standards, or about the APNIC standards from Canada, or the Japan standards for what's considered safe levels of RF energy at certain frequencies and certain power levels, which is shown as a power density in all the papers, and the 60 years of research into RF biohazard. And it turns out that both the professors that were microwave experts were of the opinion that it was dangerous and it had the possibility of causing cancer. So, yep, I consider it safe. Let me drop.
Don't worry about that noise, Chris. Just go right on.
Okay, that's fine. I consider it safe. I consider cell phones even against the head safe. Even after studying it carefully, I consider standing directly under a cell base station safe because they only transmit about 20 watts. You can go down the list. You can look up the SAR ratings on the cell phones if you want. And I actually picked a cell phone on purpose that had a high SAR rating because that means it works. So obviously, I'm not concerned about it. Back to net, KB2IQN.
Thank you, Chris. Good information. Chris was taking his Master's of Electrical Engineering course at New Paltz when he made that presentation about 6 months ago. And what's amazing is that the Master's level Electrical Engineering teachers at New Paltz, among other schools, I'm not singling out that school, also had believed the popular opinions that radio frequency energy, that microwave energy is dangerous, that it creates cancer, and that cell sites are dangerous, and cell phones are not necessarily dangerous. They got it backwards. The cell site itself radiates an amount of energy that's like 20 watts, 30 watts maximum or so, and it's no closer than 200 feet from you because of the altitude, the angles of the antennas, and whatever. The cell phone against your head a quarter of an inch away is capable of giving you 1 million times more RF energy in your head than if you live directly next door to the cell site. You tell that to an electrical engineering class, a professor, or a zoning board, and again, they just can't possibly believe it. They look at they look at the 150-foot high tower, the $500,000 worth of hardware, $500,000 of hardware, and they're positive that that's a thing. Just a couple of ounce thing in their hand, they're convinced it's safe. I'm convinced it's safe. But when it comes to the relative safety of cell site versus cell phone, they've got it completely backwards. So we're responding to vocabulary words of microwave and RF radiation. It's the words we're responding to, the misapplication of the vocabulary, not the real science involved. Chris was amazed how much the students in the class and the professors had been misunderstanding this all of their life, reading these poorly written news reports and hearing the opinions of all of their friends and not looking into any of the particulars.
Yeah, that's correct. Matter of fact, unfortunately, the partner I had was refusing to even read the papers to find out that it was safe. And I also made a calculation for, based on the power level and the antenna pattern, how close you had to be to the antenna before it was unsafe, and it was around 3 or 4 feet. You literally have to be on the tower in front of the antenna before it's considered unsafe.
Yeah, I've done that exact same calculation that Chris is talking about. You take the 30 watts out of the antenna, the gain of the antenna, the frequencies being used, and whatever. You put it all together and make a real calculation. If you're on a 150-foot high hook and ladder of your local fire department and you're standing directly in front of the antenna at a 5-foot range, not the 500 feet of the moratorium requirement, and you'll find out that it's safe. You get down to about 3 feet before it becomes unsafe. You say those words before a zoning board, and again, they'll think you're absolutely crazy. They misunderstand the science of it all. And by the way, Eric, apparently when I listen on the full duplex mode, apparently the guy was close to me transmitting on 8.5, and I was hearing sounds that I thought were coming over the repeater that apparently they're not coming over the repeater. So I guess you're saying at the time the repeater was a lot cleaner than I knew about, and I was misinterpreting. Is that approximately what was going on, Eric? KETJ, K2L.
Can you copy me, Dick?
Yes, I'm hearing you. Go right ahead.
I don't want to see yet. Something would probably be sensing your receiver, but the repeater was clean.
Very good information there. I was being spoofed. I got to be a little smart. I should have realized that one of the high-gain antennas aimed at the repeater was not getting the noise. A low-gain antenna that was going to my earphones was getting the noise. And so it was coming in at some other angle. I should have realized what was going on. All right, slowly getting smarter. Let's see, there's another comment I was going to make. Oh, yes. We've got to tell Bernie to use a little bit more audio. Are you going to tell me that was coming? Was not a repeater?
Real, Dick. That's real.
That's what I thought. That's what. We've got to tell. That's how Bernie. To put out more. Bernie's particular microphone. In. Quite low in. Okay. Alrighty. Eric, this time last week, you recommended.
High percentage of the population seems to have on that particular subject.
Let's see if John's got anything he wants to add to all of this jazz. KC2WGB. K2IIW. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to get through on. I think you can on your particular method. Go ahead, John. K2IIW. Interesting subject. Unfortunately, John, you are out of the repeater. I was hearing you on the input. And I'll repeat John's question. John is asking the question, will Chris's father be getting a real working computer sometime in the future? What John is referring to, of course, is that what is it called now? The macro camera, electronic macro camera, only works on a Windows-based system, and we have a Linux-based system in the house. So John is trying to force us to get the Linux-based system so that system become operational. I think Chris will eventually have some more Windows capability in our computers in our house. I don't think Chris is going to be able to get through on the 2.5 input, but I'll be able to hear him on the input, I believe. I'm going to go there right now. KB2IQN, if you've got a question, an answer on that one. KB2IW.
You are currently connected to Reflector 9126.
And be able to get the camera to work, because there's a certain piece of software that I need that needs libraries such that I'd have to put your computer in a bad state in order to get it loaded. But the second answer is, right now I'm actually learning how to do Debian packaging, so there's a chance I could actually, if I was really diligent and had to do a lot of work, backport the program that does function to the older version of KDE that you've got. K2RIW, KB2IQN.
That came through very well, Chris, and I thank you. Okay, so Chris is working on it, John. Hang in there. The cavalry is coming over the hill. So there will be a solution sometime in the future. Chris is giving us all the details of the Debian and of the Linux system that we've got, and the fact that right now I've got an older version of a Linux system on my particular computer. So a solution will happen. See, what else was I going to ask John? Don't remember now. Of all the subjects we've covered tonight, and any new subject, if a person within the sound of my voice wants to add comments or bring up a brand new question, you have your opportunity to do it right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. And just talk over that noise. Looks like it's not going to be that easy. So I think getting back to the magnetic motor, the back EMF, and whether or not you can X-ray. I think the guy used the word very loosely. Under normal circumstances, an X-ray will not demonstrate a magnetic field. People make an assumption that since the magnetic resonance imaging, an MRI machine, does work by magnetic field, people make the mistake of assuming that a magnetic field can be plotted on an MRI machine, that you can get an X-ray of magnetism. I'm reasonably sure that that's not true. So I think the guy was a little bit loose with the words when he was drawing those diagrams of what the magnetic field looks like inside of a motor while it rotates. And he seemed to be fighting a back EMF, and there's nothing wrong with back EMF. It's a very friendly thing. There's nothing bad about it. You don't have to avoid it. And to change the phasing of the individual poles of a rotary magnetic motor, there's not a great deal of magic in that, because essentially all of the high-power brushless DC motors have been doing that for lots of years. Every one of those airplane motors that Chris and I see at the NEAT fair every year, they are using these kinds of motors where the individual poles are misplaced from each other. And they don't worry about the back EMF. They intentionally use the back EMF to tell the electronics where is the exact position of the propeller, so to speak, the rotation of the motor, so it knows which coils to turn on when. The timing is all indicated by the desirable characteristics of the back EMF. We don't have to put a separate set of wires in there to do that. The three-phase coils that are already there, the coil that's not being driven, is generating back EMF. That is used by the electronics to figure out exactly what is the rate of rotation, the direction of rotation, and the exact position of the propeller at that instant of time. That's the way the system works. Over to you for any comments on this, John. TC2WGB, K2IOW in the TechNet.
Arc generator, and I bring it up to about 50,000 volts, I do get contamination on the film. I've tried different magnets in front of the film, and it does not seem to affect the arc of the exposure. The lines that are drawn, it doesn't seem to change it much, so I don't know if the energy of the X-ray is so high that it doesn't see the magnetic field, or the magnetic field doesn't have an effect on it. But I am working on that, and I will give you an answer as soon as I run my next experiments, because I'm going to use a faster film and see if that's going to help. I've tried the fine grain film, and that didn't work out too well. It was about ASA 50. So I'm going to go back up to the 1027 or the 400 and see if that'll reveal anything. And by the way, you'll be getting some photographs this week, probably by the weekend, next weekend, of some interesting pieces of equipment that I've just refurbished. I think you're going to see a piece of equipment that you've never seen before.
Very fine, John. A high voltage arc definitely makes ultraviolet light. That in turn, and maybe even some very weak X-rays, and that in turn will expose film. However, when you're drawing an arc, it takes an extremely strong magnetic field to move that arc. When it comes to the 500 kilowatt or so class, or at least 5 kilowatt, the 5 kilowatt class of arc transmitter, which was used on the Titanic, and some of the later versions of that arc transmitter, an extremely strong magnet was put in the vicinity of the chamber that contained the arc, and the reason for the strong magnet was so that the arc would walk itself around, so that the arc would walk around that terminal as opposed to burning a hot spot in one place and melting down the terminal. So I think you got a little bit more desirable sound out of the arc when it comes to the actual signal that got transmitted, and the fact that the very strong magnetic field would move the arc itself. In other words, if you've got a cylinder that's the anode and a probe in the center that's the cathode or vice versa, and you draw an arc between the two, and you've got a right angle magnetic field along the line of the probe, then the magnetic field will walk around that device, very similar to what happens inside of a magnetron tube. And so you can walk the arc that way, but other than that, I don't think it changes the wavelength or it does any other deflection, and it takes an extremely strong magnet to do that. So I'm not quite sure what you were trying to do with the magnetron. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, I was trying to see if I could force the X-rays that were impinging on the film to move to a different location, because I was thinking it along the lines of what we call blowout coils, which I'm sure you've heard of, on heavy switching. We have magnets which will cause the arc to move in an upward direction away from the contact points so that we don't have an established arc for any length of time. And they're called blowout coils. So I thought that possibly, I know it will move the arc, but I didn't know if it would move the point of where the X-rays were landing on the film. That's what I was trying to do.
Okay, let me give you some opinions on this one. As you go to higher and higher frequencies and shorter wavelengths, your ability to bend the propagated wave itself becomes less and less. As you go to ultraviolet frequencies, you need different materials to make a lens for a camera. As you go to the region of soft X-rays and hard X-rays, a lens no longer is a lens. The X-rays will go right through the lens and ignore it. There are some lensing techniques you can do at X-rays. A grazing incident type of lens is used on the Chandra X-ray telescope. but the amount of bending of the ray of the X-ray by that lens is extremely minor. And it takes a lot of heroic hardware to do it. So as you go to shorter wavelengths, higher and higher frequencies, the wave becomes, I'm going to call it stiff, more stiff. It doesn't bend. And a simple magnetic field to bend the radiated wave, I think, is out of the question. To bend the arc itself, yes, I'm going to give you that. By the way, the so-called blowout switch, I'm guessing the magnetic field helps you move the arc in a particular direction. And isn't there also a puff of something like sulfur hexafluoride, which also helps blow out the arc? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, those are called snuffers. They're usually enclosed in some kind of a flask. And then there's also a pressure switch, which will not allow the switch to function if the pressure of the gas is not exactly where it's supposed to be. Yeah, but these were just raw open front panel switches that had the blow-up coils on either side of the contacts.
Now, the blow-out coil, did it consist of only a magnetic field, or was there also some kind of a gas that was blown against the arc? Over to you, John.
No, it was only magnetic field, and some of them were permanent magnet types. Others are on the DC system, we actually had coils that generate the electric field.
So I think you're saying there was a carefully timed electromagnet that was turned on at the same time you opened up the switch and created the arc. So now you've got not only a strong local magnetic field made by that solenoid, but a magnetic field that's changing in a particular direction, north-south, at a particular rate. And the combination of the magnetic field being established and moving at a certain rate, I think may be contributed to the snuffing of that arc. Is there any possibility of that being how it worked, John? Go ahead.
Yes, I believe just as if there was a wire that was conducting, say, DC, and you had a pulse of magnetic field on the right and left of it, you would see that wire move, and you would adjust those magnets so that it would move up, and that's where the arc would go. It would just cause that. Of course, the angle of the contact starts to open up. They're not coming apart in a parallel fashion. They're coming apart in a conical fashion, and that causes the arc to raise by itself, and then the magnets would finish the job. And without those magnets, you burn the contacts up in maybe 2 or 3 days. Otherwise, they'll last for months.
Very nice. Now, I think this was shipboard power system you're describing. I am curious what voltage was being interrupted, what number of amperes were being interrupted, and because the wiring of the ship had lots of length to it, therefore lots of inductance, you were really getting a higher voltage on interrupt due to inductive kickback, is a guess on my part. So what voltage, what current, and do you believe there was some inductive kickback taking place simultaneously, maybe even by magnetic machinery like transformers and motors? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. The minimum currents we were running were 800 amperes on these contactors, up to some of them were up to 5, 6,000 amperes, and definitely inductive loads, and that's why we'd have this tremendous damage. These contacts are approximately an inch thick. They're, let's see, they were silver, sterling silver, amount for lower resistivity, and they're very expensive, and that prevented them from burning up. And when those coils would open up, or something would be defective, those contacts would burn up in a couple of days. Amazing. But 800 amps was the minimum we were working with in those circuits.
So 800 amperes being interrupted, sometimes thousands of amperes. I'm guessing this was probably 400 cycle power. And I'm guessing we're talking about either 240 volts or even 440 volts. Over to you, John.
Mainly DC. It was 440 and up to 1200 volts.
So in the worst case combination, are you saying that the DC voltage could be as high as 1200 volts and the amperes could be a few hundred amperes going to a magnetic machine of some kind, motor, transformer, or so on. It has to be a motor. So it's going to a DC motor, and while hundreds of amperes are flowing at 1200 volts, you had to open a switch to interrupt that particular inductive kickback. The total number of Henrys in that motor, and 1/2 Li squared is the number of joules of watt-seconds of energy stored in that motor, and all of that inductive kickback came flying back at you when you opened up that switch. And my guess is you heard some very interesting sounds when you did that. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Yep. Oh, on opening, you'd hear some buzzing noise, a real irritating type of buzz. And on closure, it was like a lightning strike. And these were some of these devices were multi-contacts driving, say, 165 horsepower motors, and the voltages on those were around 440.
Out of curiosity, was the 440 AC or DC? And you said it sounded like a firecracker or something like that when you closed the contact. When you opened it, you heard this buzzing sound. Out of curiosity, how long did the buzz last, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, these were DC, and that buzz lasted for the length that the arc maintained. As soon as the arc broke, of course, you got a little crack, but the buzzing would stop. And these, I think they had 104 pounds of pressure on the contacts when they made them.
So you're saying 104 pounds of pressure is the force with which they came together to make sure you were making a really good contact, and maybe the contacts came together and wiped a little bit to make sure that you got rid of any carbon on the surface. And when you heard that buzzing sound on interrupt, roughly how long did that last? Half a second? 3 seconds? Over to you, John.
I would say approximately a second, and you're right, they were wiping contacts, of course.
And those actual motors, were these motors that were operating a bilge pump or a crane? What were those motors actually doing, John? Go ahead.
Yes, many times it was a crane. Also, printing presses. The 165 horsepower motors were used on the printing presses, which had a lot of overturn on the motors when it got a failure of some mechanism, whether they had a paper break or whatever. You had all this tremendous these cylinders with these lead plates that were spinning around. You had, let's see, maybe 30 cylinders, a couple of tons of material spinning very quickly would cause a lot of overrunning. So we had all kinds of dynamic braking and stuff like that to bring it down quickly. But the arc would last about a second, and it was like a welded flash. It was bright.
K2YL. Okay, your audio sounds quite a bit better, Bernie. Go right ahead.
Same radio, same situation. Oh, well. But, you know, we're running out of time.
Okay. I guess it's time we quit for the night then. I thank you very much, Bernie, and Eric, John, and everyone else who signed in tonight. This was TechNet number 1,393 of the series that began in September of 1982. That is what now? 29 and a half years ago. With as long as the creek don't rise, the same crew of people with some other additions will be back next week using slightly different techniques, which will be required. What else is new? We have to adapt. I say 73, you all, be kind to each other. Try to be kind to each other. And the people who think they've really got to have control, you guys got to lighten up a little bit. Back to you, Bernie, for any other final comments, and then I'll send it over to John in that order. K2YO, K2RIW.
Good night, everyone. Dick, John, thanks for the TechNet. I love having you guys around. K2YO clear.
There's a guy with good taste. John, and you guys, John, you're the guys who are writing to you are getting some very interesting antenna ideas. They're giving me ideas, and I'm awful glad. Tell them to keep doing it, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
I certainly will, Dick. And if they want to, just remember it. Juliet Bravo 5 at OscarOscar.com, and we'll get your questions into Dick. And Dick, you have a great tomorrow. Oh, actually, it's today. It's after 12. And thank you very much for your time. KC2WGB.
Let me try. try one other thing, though he might be out of range. Make a quick transmission, Chris, if you're within range. KB2, India, Quebec, November. If you're within range, make a brief transmission, Chris. K2RIW.
I heard him on the input, fine.
K2RIW, KB2IQN. I'm actually nearing the, what was it again? Tappan Zee Bridge, I think it is. Can you hear me okay?
Very close to dead full quiet. Just a tiny bit of thicket fencing. Okay, that's good. That's a good rig you got there. Too bad we haven't put in the high power transmitter on it yet. We got to do that, as well as finish off that antenna on your on the home QTH. Back to you for any final, and you sound good. KB2IQN, K2RIW.
No, I don't think I have anything else to add at this time. Just wanted to say thanks and good night. Cheers. KB2IQN.
Hello, Chris. Great hearing you in there. KC2WGB.
Not for those cell phones. Bye-bye, you all. And do be kind to each other. KQRAW clear. See you guys analog.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
The time is 1:10. This is the W2L Amateur Radio repeater. Morning. Time is 1:31 a.m. Good morning. Welcome to the L repeater. The time is 1:54. Is the W2L amateur radio repeater. Good morning. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2L repeater. The time is 3:01 a.m. Is the W2L amateur radio repeater. W2, good morning. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2. The time is 4:10 a.m. Good morning. Is the amateur radio repeater. The time is 4:22 a.m. To repeater system. Good morning. Welcome to the W2L repeater. The time is 4 a.m. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2 amateur radio. W2L repeater system. Morning. The time is 5:10. Good morning. Welcome to the W2L repeater. Oh.
Thank you.